It is Thursday afternoon when KRVS presents From the Poet's Bookshelf with Louisiana poet Darryl Bourque, reading works by writers from or inspired by Louisiana.
We continue today with another poem by David Kirby from The Biscuit Joint, a recent publication by LSU Press. 10,000 hours with you. Nobody in our adorable little one-horse town knows whether Turandot is pronounced with a long or a short O, or if the T is voiced or silent, so I write the opera critic Anthony Tomasini at the New York Times, and he says that the vast majority of people in the opera world pronounce the character's name as Turandot, like Spot. And I think, now there's a good fellow, courteous, well-informed, not so full of himself that he can't write to a country mouse like me. And so I post his reply as a Facebook status update, and you'd think that'd settle it, that the opera lovers of Tallahassee would let go of their plow handles and wipe their sweaty brows with their bandanas and say, "Well, looky here, Ma, this newspaper fella says he knows how to pronounce it, and he ought to know, him being Italian and all." But no. My update hasn't been online for more than 15 seconds before someone writes that Puccini's scholar Patrick Vincent Casali has written an article in which he says that the current practice of pronouncing the final T in Turandot's name is incorrect, and the next thing you know, people are weighing in as though Anthony Tomasini and I hadn't settled the whole thing just moments before. But that's human nature for you, isn't it? In study after study, researchers have established something they call the 10,000 hours rule, which says that's how long it takes to get really good at something. Cello playing, archery, poetry, safe cracking, chess, you name it. And therefore, you should expect to put in about 20 hours a week over a period of 10 years before you're an expert. Then again, most of us have spent more time than that in cars, yet we still drive the wrong way on freeways, cross into the other guy's lane while texting, careen off cliffs, and if we are James Dean or Jane Mansfield, we get hit head-on by 23-year-old Cal Poly student Donald Turnipseed, or plow into the rear of a semi that has slowed because of a truck spraying mosquito fog, prompting the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to require an underride guard on all trailer tractors to minimize the damage of future mishaps. When you come right down to it, we do our best, or think we do, which amounts to the same thing. Historian Doug Blackman tells me that half of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings' kids looked like her and stayed on at Monticello as slaves, whereas the ones that looked like TJ ran away and became white people, so that today there are hundreds of thousands of white folks out there who are A, black, and B, Thomas Jefferson's descendants, though they don't know it, and now they're doing yoga and drinking designer coffee and going to Wes Anderson movies, and they don't really like any of this, but they have to do it because they're white. To me, New York is the place where people know how to pronounce every word correctly, seeing how every language group is represented there. Although not even New Yorkers can manage Houston Street. Or a New Yorker might want to say, "I'm right," for example, and have it come out, "I'm white," which isn't the same thing. Or if you say Bell and you thought I called you Bel, an Indian thorn tree, or Bel, the Babylonian god. I'd like to say everything to you and say it right. Imagine sitting next to me on the subway, either in New York or just in your mind. I might be the great-great-grand-something of a U.S. president, you know. I'll lean over and say, beauty to you. And you look at me and say, beast.
Join KRVS each Thursday afternoon for From the Poet's Bookshelf with Louisiana poet Darryl Bourque. And with me in the KRVS studios this afternoon, I'm very happy to say, are Sean Roy and Chun Kyat Lim, who are both with the UL School of Music. Chun Kyat Lim is a pianist, teaches piano, and Sean is director of the UL Opera Theater. People so enjoy the performances that you all do. But you all have a life together as a duo, playing, accompanying Sean, singing a wide variety of music. I know that you all have recorded a CD? How many?
Yes, y'all? Just one.
Uh-huh. Just one CD? Mm-hmm. And you all are very interested in music that is not often performed. Mm-hmm. In fact, very not often recorded either.
Correct.
So tell us just a bit about that CD, and then we're going to talk about the concert that you all are doing this coming Sunday.
Okay. Well, the CD that we have is called American Kaleidoscope. Mm-hmm. It came out about, I think, almost a year and a half ago, in December of 2002. So it features four American composers because we were really interested in championing works by American composers, but also new works, like you said, that's not been recorded a lot. In fact, two of the works on there, by Willem Bolcom and Ned Roram, these are Pulitzer Prize winners, have never been recorded before. So it was the premiere, world premiere recording. So we were very excited about that. So we continued to do this quest, but we had been doing that music for quite a bit now. Not just this music on the CDs, but just promoting new composers. Mm-hmm. So this new concert that we're doing actually is a melange of kind of some old stuff and some new stuff.
Well, tell us what it is that attracted you in this quest, as you say, to search out music, particularly American music, that has not often been performed or recorded. What was it about that literature?
I think we've discussed this before and probably on air before. It's that both of us had an affinity for it. We just kind of liked it. I mean, I've always enjoyed contemporary music. And as an American, I felt the need to promote my own composers and living composers a lot. And I know Chun Kyat has one of your research areas in your doctorate was about American composition. So therefore, I think that's why. And I just like it. I don't find it – a lot of people are scared of it because it's hard to learn and – it's inaccessible sometimes, but we really looked hard and we found pieces that were more accessible vocally and in every way for the listener also. It's quite lovely, lovely music.
So what creates the complexity that you're talking about in some of this American music?
It's a combination of different things. Yeah. I mean, I think the harmonies are different.
Yeah, hard to hear sometimes.
Mm-hmm. But the thing is that a lot of people think of 20th century music or modern music as just one type of music. But what is interesting about the 20th century or, leading to the 21st century is that there's so many different types of trends that occurred. Mm-hmm. Just in the 20th century alone, you have Impressionism and Neo-Romanticism and Minimalism. I mean, just array of different styles. And so there are so many things that, you can draw from in the last century versus Romantic period where the styles are sort of the same. Of course, each composer has different voices, a different voice. But, in the 20th century, I think it is just a very exciting time. Mm-hmm. The other reason for me, too, I think, is that for people to sort of understand this literature, you have to expose the music to, you have to put the music out there for them to listen and to make it available. So I always, in my literature classes, I think, I talk about, like, The Rite of Spring, when it was first composed, it was like, you know, there was a riot. You know, it was, you know, people couldn't accept it. I mean, people were battling in the concert stage. And, you know, 50 years later, it was considered one of the masterworks of the 20th century. But I think you just have to kind of take the first step. Mm-hmm. And as part of what we do as teachers, too, is that we are trying to educate our students about that.
Well, and it needs to be recorded. You need to be able to play it for your students so that it becomes very common.
Right.
We all know the Rite of Spring because we've just heard it many, many times.
Right, sure. Right.
And I, you know, I think audiences tend to be scared. They hear, oh, that's going to be contemporary music, and they go, oh, well, that's going to be ugly. And like I said, you know, like I said before, we really looked for pieces that are beautiful, and they're so, I mean, they're almost post-romantic in, you know, in their beauty. First of all, as a singer, I'm personally less interested in singing something that's ugly or that's really, you know,
angular
that's really hard to sing, and it's hard to find a vocal technique for that. So we tend to like, just normal singers tend to like something with a vocal line or something that has, you know, has a lovely melody. And I think most of the things we picked.
You know, the other interesting thing that I think about when I think about 20th century literature or performing these works is that you have the opportunity to work with these composers.
Yes.
You know, like, you know, I could record Beethoven and Mozart, but it would be my interpretation. I don't really know if that's what he really intended to be. But whereas with these composers, most of them living, we were able to coach with these composers and send our recordings to them. And they were able to tell us exactly what they wanted or did not want. So we feel confident that what we have out, our interpretation is pretty authentic to what the composer wants. And I think that is sort of fulfilling in itself.
Well, and I would imagine that they're utterly delighted that somebody wants to record
their music
and flesh out this,
and for us too,
work that otherwise remains two-dimensional on a page.
That's true.
Sure.
In a drawer.
Like the Balkan piece is one that had been written for a particular singer. He was the winner of a competition, and his prize was to have this piece written for him. Well, he did it. He performed it, and that's the last anybody ever heard of it, I think, until we found it and picked it up, and then we got to go to his home in Michigan, and he and his wife and performed it for them and got their feedback, and it was fantastic.
And now,
you know,
and
I'm sure they were like,
recorded.
Okay, wow, somebody wants to record this piece.
Right.
So it adds to his discography also.
As we're talking about this, I'm imagining just scores and scores and scores of scores in drawers all over, just crying to be let out.
And not just of that. What was fun when we were there, his wife, who's also a wonderful performer, her name is Joan Morris, started digging in her music and pulled out some music. She said, oh, here's some pieces that Ned Roram gave me. Here, why don't you take them? I never sang them. They're not right for me. And she just gave them to us. So I have them in my library now, these unpublished pieces by Ned Roram in my library.
Now, did y'all do any Roram?
Yes. That was the world premiere recording of that beautiful cycle that he wrote in 1952 that had never been recorded. Two pieces out of the 10 were recorded with him playing and Donald Graham singing, and that was it.
But the set of 10 pieces.
It's a beautiful piece.
Yeah. And so that was kind of, you know, a treat for us.
Yes.
But also Ned Roram is in his 80s already.
Yeah,
so it was kind of really an honor for us to get to, you know, record this piece before his death and sort of get an approval from him. That really meant a lot to us. Yeah.
Incredible. And I do want to tell people, and I say this every time I have music professors here, that this is all in addition to everything else you all do.
Right.
In the School of Music, you're teaching, you're performing with the students, everything you do there. This is your professional life in addition to that. And you're traveling around the country finding these pieces, and you're on the road as well.
It's a lot of time.
Concerts.
But we do it because we need to for ourselves. And I need to for my soul.
And
I can't just stop performing because it's too much a part of my
existence. You can't just
my existence.
Others in performing.
You have, and plus it shows our students, you know, as an example. Of,
This is something you can do your entire life. That you perform, that
it
you research,
go away.
That you can record.
It's a passion, you keep doing
we
it.
We hope to anyway.
Yes, we hope, yes. Until the old voice holds out.
Well, and sometimes you don't know the extent to which you inspire others until many, many, many years later.
We hope to,
absolutely. If you are just tuning in, my guests are Sean Roy and Chan Kiat Lim, both with the UL School of Music, here talking about their work that they do as a duo. They have recorded a CD, and they are performing together this Sunday, a mm-hmm. concert called Love and Remembrance. Mm-hmm. It's going to be in the evening, and so you can finish your weekend of socializing and the Mardi Gras and everything going on, and and finish it off with this amazing concert with the two of you. What will the program be? You mentioned that you'll include a couple pieces that might be on your CD.
Mm-hmm. We're opening with the song cycle by John Duke called Three Gothic Ballads. And I think we chose to open with it because it's familiar to us. Mm-hmm. And it's a good way to start a program.
And one of the pieces that's on our CD.
And it's on our CD. Yeah. And it's the only composer on our CD that's no longer with us. He passed away in 1984, mm-hmm. but was a wonderful post-romantic composer, just beautiful music. Mm-hmm. And so the first set is these three songs. Then we decided, I think we both had a hankering after being 8 years working with mm-hmm. contemporary music to just sing some romantic music and something else. So we started pulling stuff that we just always wanted to sing. I had always wanted to sing something in Russian and that wonderful music by Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky and those guys. Mm-hmm. But the language was always a barrier for me. But I decided, well, it's time. So we looked for some mm-hmm. Rachmaninoff, and which is obviously one of Jean Kiat's favorite composers because he was such an incredible, composer for the piano. And but he wrote some beautiful songs.
So what did you all choose from Rachmaninoff?
It's one of his opuses. It's the first three songs of his Opus 4. Mm-hmm. And we're fortunate that one of Jean Kiat's students, who is a doctoral student in math, mm-hmm. is also, while he's here, he's from Serbia, and he's getting his bachelor's in piano mm-hmm. and studies with Jean Kiat. Therefore, he became my Russian coach because he knows the language.
He's getting his doctorate in
math.
Math, yes. And his BA in music.
While he's here.
Yes.
And he speaks Russian, so he's been my Russian coach. So his name is Voya Petrovich, and I was very happy to have him, and he's a great guy.
So the piece by Rachmaninoff, does it have a very characteristic Russian sound? I think many people in their heads, they know Russian choruses and that beautiful religious choral sound.
I think it really captures sort of like the harmonies and richness of mm-hmm. of Rachmaninoff, you know, that post-romantic emotionalism mm-hmm. that is so true mm-hmm. for Rachmaninoff. It's definitely apparent in these pieces.
It's excess, which is what it is. I mean, it's just like you can just lay your soul into it.
You have the most tender moments mm-hmm. and then the most passionate moments as well. I mean, it's really, really
ultimately
fun.
Ultimately romantic music. Yeah.
God, which is what y'all were going for after this.
Of course.
Right.
American. So how has it been learning the Russian?
It's a challenge. I had sung once before in Russian in a choral situation. And when you're in a choral situation, you can not be perfect, and nobody will know. But when you're by yourself, it's a little more challenging.
Exactly.
It's an interesting language. It's mm-hmm. It's gotten easier, but mm-hmm. at the beginning it was kind of like, huh? Mm-hmm. Say that again.
But does that really help in your interpretation of the song? I mean, I'm sure there's some people who do mm-hmm. translations of songs, but does that help to sing it in the language?
It does. Yeah. The 'cause you. In studying the language with him, he would point out aspects of how it should be pronounced that are so different from mm-hmm. singing an Italian piece, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. like the position of the L vowel. Because in English, in Italian, the L is very tip of the tongue, L, la, 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 la. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Russian, you have to touch the middle of the back of your L, which is very dark, and which mm-hmm. is why their language mm-hmm. sounds so dark, and all their singers sound dark. And the minute I started doing that, blüvnyo, mm-hmm. it gave me that feel of the language. Mm-hmm.
But he was able to help you with that.
It adds to the music. I mean, mm-hmm. it sounds right. He even said at our last coaching, he went, man, that some of that sounds really Russian. I'm like, well, thank God.
But I think
he meant it sounds authentic, because and it's just sometimes just the flavor of a language. If mm-hmm. you can find that, it just makes it sound right.
Yeah.
It may not be perfect, but it's – the people buy it,
Sounds beautiful. We'll look forward to that wonderful, romantic mm-hmm. Rachmaninoff. And then you have another R, Ravel, which is mm-hmm. a little lighter, but very,
very different.
How did you choose that piece?
Well, the Ravel, we actually performed it a while ago, mm-hmm. and it's actually a set of three pieces based on the character Don Quixote. Mm-hmm. And so this is very interesting. It's sort of like has a tremendous audience appeal because most people are familiar with the character. And also each of these pieces is very descriptive. Like there's a drinking song, and that's when he was trying to has this imaginary woman that he's in love with and that he's serenading to her. And then the middle one is more sort of religious, very spiritual. They're very different, but people can relate to it easily. So it's really fun.
It's kind of a story.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. Yeah, the Don Quixote Dulcinea, yeah. That's the name. And they're very standard repertoire for a baritone. Mm-hmm. Everybody does them. We're only doing a piece that everybody does. Okay. But they're so programmable, and people love them. And, you know, they always get, so far when we've performed them, they've gotten the biggest reaction of the evening. Because I think they're just fun.
Amazing concert that you've described so far. Beautiful pieces that you all have recorded that no one else has. And then we get this great Russian interpretation.
Right.
You don't get to hear that much.
By Sean Roy. And then the Ravel. And then, of course, Schumann. Is that you're going to finish out the program?
That's our first half with the Ravel. Then we have Act Two, as I like to call it, with one of the great song cycles of all time.
In a way, when we built this program, that was our anchor. That was our meat.
We started with Schumann.
We had both wanted to perform this at never done it before, and I remember that one of my earliest years in grad school, I've heard a performance of it, or you know, by Schumann, and actually just fell in love with it. And I've been wanting to do that for decades now. You know, that's giving away my age, but I always wanted to do it. And these are just the masterworks by these composers like Schubert and Schumann. They just have wonderful song cycles for the piano and for the voice. And this is one particular one that we had talked about, actually Sean and I, for several years. But we have never done that because we've been focused on our project of recording this new music. So finally, I think it is a very rewarding experience for us.
Come to fruition. Here we are. Going to do it.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about this song cycle.
It's Schumann's Dichterliebe, which means the poet's love. And it is a journey. It's 16 songs. Some of them are 30 seconds long. I mean, it's 27 minutes in total. So it's our entire second half. But it's a true journey of a man from falling in love to being squashed upon and by the woman, and the bitter and angriness he goes through, all the stages of falling in love, breaking up, and then very slowly coming around and having to, at the end, decide to bury, literally, in a large coffin, his pain and his suffering so he can continue with life.
Sounds like a range of emotions you are called upon.
It is.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was talking about it the other day because now that we've gotten to perform it twice, it's like, okay, this piece is not as difficult vocally for me as the first half, but emotionally, it's incredibly. It takes so much out of you because it's just draining, emotionally. To have to transition from piece to piece, you know, when there's silence because there should not be applause because it's one long story. You know, it's quite riveting, you know, for the singer to go through.
I'm sure in 27 minutes, emotions that for so many people
that you cover a lifetime.
Yes.
And that's why when my students talk about. And even I'm sure when I was younger, I said, oh, I want to sing that. And you go, no.
No, you're not.
You have to wait 20 years or thick. And now I understand as I'm getting older. Now I can understand this piece. It makes sense. You have to have lived.
Yeah. Well, we're kind of talking with Sean here as though the vocalist is the main.
No, not at all. No, because Schumann did amazing things with the piano.
These emotions are also going
absolutely,
on.
Absolutely,
The piano part as well.
It all goes together.
In fact, this whole program, actually, all the composers who were programming, they're actually all fine pianists. I mean, Ravel, and Rachmaninoff, and Schumann, even Duke. And these are all composers for the piano, and they're all pianists, actually. And so the piano part is just as substantial. And in fact, a lot of times people always think that when I play with the with a vocalist that I'm accompanying versus like I'm collaborating. But these songs are song cycles where the two parts are very equal. And for most of the songs for the Schumann, the piano sort of has like an ending, sort of like finishes off the emotion of the text almost.
Yeah, I was discussing this in my class this morning with my class voice because I'm teaching them a Schumann song, and it has an 8-measure postlude, I call it. And almost every one of these pieces has that, where the piano really finishes the piece. I'm just left, and then there's this long, extended, wonderful.
So it's really a duet.
And it's some of the best music in the song, is because Schumann was such a fantastic writer for the piano. So,
which makes it sort of gratifying. In fact, like when we recorded the Rorum, one of his songs, number 9, is just for solo piano.
Yeah, it's just a piano interlude, it's called.
How these composers kind of think about their song, so to speak, you know, that it is sung by the piano.
And it recalls themes from the rest of the songs.
Right. They're not seeing a boundary between the the voice and, and the
instrument. It's not just,
it's all instruments.
I'm going to play some chords while you're singing. You know?
And we're constantly handing over stuff. But the wonderful thing about collaborating with Sean is that, you know, I think he feeds me so much stuff and that I think it helps in terms of the performance. And that is always true when you're collaborating with somebody, mm-hmm. to have a good partner. I think that, you know, that synthesis is really what makes it exciting.
Yes.
Because it's, you know, our parts separately is not as powerful as what's put together.
Oh, God. Yeah. And I mean, the same thing here. We, in rehearsal, it's because you're so tunnel vision on what your part is and what I have to do and making sure my, you know, my German is correct as much as I can and everything is right. And then he'll go, well, my melody here does this. And I'm like, oh, okay. Sure, you have a melody, okay. And so that's collaboration. It's wonderful because then you start listening for that and you feed on that and you make yours meld together with it. So that's just the wonderful thing about this repertoire, too, is that Schumann was a master of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, a wonderful opportunity for all of us. And,
and it's a piece, and I'm finding these huge song cycles are not being performed as much as they used to. So it's a rare opportunity to get to hear one. So come on out.
Definitely. Sunday evening.
Sunday evening. Be there.
And it's free, as we said.
Free.
Free concert. It will be in the Duke Craig Guilfrey Auditorium.
Yes.
And the School of Music is presenting a lot of material this coming week. I know tomorrow evening, you just had a guest artist last night. Tomorrow evening, New York Voices.
New York Voices. An amazing opportunity for this city to have.
Right.
So come out.
And you can buy tickets at the door. Any UL faculty, staff, or students can get in free on Friday.
Yes.
And then your concert Sunday evening at 7:30, and just this gorgeous duet and an opportunity to hear this music that you would not otherwise hear, and these two fabulous performers that are in our university and our community, Chong Kiat Lim and Sean Roy. You mentioned that there is another guest artist next week.
Another guest artist concert on Wednesday the 26th, which is next Wednesday, and Chong Ah Kim is the pianist. She is actually a German-born pianist. She currently resides in Illinois, and she's coming in to do a solo concert for us. And she's a tremendous interpreter of Bach. In fact, one of the huge monumental pieces by Bach is the Goldberg Variations that will take almost 1 hour to perform. And Chong Ah was somebody who had performed it when she was 21 or 22. You know, she was just that kind of interpreter. But she's doing a program of a Bach, a French overture, some Ravel, and also the Schumann Kreisleriana. So kind of a program that's pretty similar to ours, but really kind of a beautiful program.
Solo piano.
Solo piano. Okay. And this is Wednesday evening, again, at 7:30, and it's also free.
Also free. So many free opportunities here. How can we not participate and attend? Now, I'm sure some people are thinking, well, I'm driving, I can't write things down. But the School of Music does have a calendar.
Yes.
So if you go to the website, you have sort of like a billboard that keeps running and listing all of the... the liberal arts. So you never have to be without your School of Music schedule of performances and concerts.
You find it online.
Yes. Something happening every week over there.
Oh, every day almost now.
So take yourself, enjoy it, take your children, start
a lot
young
of it is free
off.
And we have to, you know, thank the university and for giving us these budgets to be able to bring in these artists and these artists for coming for next to nothing. And, you know, and also thank KRVS for their continued support of our School of Music and what we do and for advertising it and having us on the air.
Completely our pleasure. We look forward to that, and we look forward to many more years of great performances and recordings by everyone in the School of Music. Again, Chong Kiat Lim, Sean Roy, their performance is this coming Sunday. It's called Love and Remembrance, 7:30 on Sunday, completely free to everyone, and a great chance to hear some beautiful music. Thank you both.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us here.